Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bank of America this week announced plans to cut $5 billion in annual costs and 30,000 jobs. America's biggest bank is in teardown mode, cutting back jobs on a huge scale, facing large liabilities still from the subprime mortgage era and trying to find its way forward. Billionaire Warren Buffett has invested big in its future. Others aren't so sure what the shape of American banking is going to be. This hour on Point, Bank of America slashing 30,000 jobs and what it means. You can join the conversation. How do you read that big number, that big Bank of America cutback? What's it mean? Is there more to come? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Paul Barrett, assistant managing editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. His big story on Bank of America is on the cover this week. Paul Barrett, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And with us from New York as well is Louise Story, business reporter for the New York Times. She was one of their lead reporters on the financial crisis, the federal bailouts, and the public backlash that followed. Louise Story, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Good to be here.
Paul, first to you, you've got it on the cover this week. You know, in some ways, it's what's the problem here? $112 billion in revenues in 2010. That's a lot of cash moving through Bank of America. And it's not as though they're just, you know, sending people out the door with pink slips today. This is attrition over time. And yet that's a very big number. What are they up against? Why are they doing it, Paul?
Well, they're doing it for several reasons. The current CEO, Brian Moynihan, inherited a company that he knew in December 2009 was bloated, filled with redundant operations, and in deep financial trouble. And in fact, he got the job as CEO telling the board that what we needed to do in the bank is get back to basic banking operations and shed a lot of the extraneous acquisitions that had been made by his predecessor. So in some ways, what you're seeing now is an undoing of what went on for years and years during an era of banking gigantism. A second thing you're seeing is something approaching panic on Wall Street over the uncertainty of Bank of America's lingering liabilities related to the subprime mortgage crisis. The problem is that investors and analysts and others simply don't have their arms around how much Bank of America is eventually going to have to pay out as a result of acquiring Countrywide Financial, one of the worst of the subprime mortgage factories that Bank of America acquired during its acquisition spree in 2008.
And the expenses, the lingering liabilities that come along with that look like what? What kind of scale and why are they there, Paul?
Well, the scale is tens of billions of dollars, and they're there because those cruddy mortgages that Countrywide wrote and serviced were sold and bundled into mortgage securities, which were purchased by investors, guaranteed by federally backed agencies. And all of that, those bad securities are still out there and people are very unhappy to own them. So you have some major investors who are demanding that Bank of America take some of the mortgages back. You have other investors who are suing for damages. And you've got prosecutors, both state and federal, who are investigating various aspects of both Countrywide's behavior and Bank of America's behavior. The bank, Moynihan, has been trying basically to settle these cases, to put a price tag on all of this. But that's proved to be very, very difficult. And while eventually this run of lawsuits will dissipate, it hasn't yet. And as I say, no one can tell exactly what the price tag is going to be.
We'll look at the housing piece of this. It is huge in Bank of America's case and in many other banks and financial institutions as well. Louise Story, though, what about this issue of undoing the banking gigantism, Paul calls it? We all saw that too big to fail, and we saw more consolidation after the collapse in of 07-08. Are we now rolling back, too big to fail? Is this the banking industry, Bank of America, as it pares down, fixing the problem with its own kind of retrenchment?
Well, you know, too big to fail in part is because these big conglomerates have lots of different types of businesses under them, and we only have a few of these giant banks. We're not seeing these banks split into pieces. You know, that would really be an undoing of the too big to fail would be if they split down into pieces and they had consumer banking over here and they had investment banking over there. That's not what we're seeing. What we are seeing instead is they are shedding people from every single business. And this is very much the banking bubble bursting. So, you know, we saw the housing bubble burst. One thing that is widely accepted as being part of the contribution to the financial crisis is that the banks became too big of a part of the economy.
The financialization of the American economy.
Yes. I mean, you had finance became the biggest segment of the S&P index from 2001 until the financial crisis began. And part of that was because the banks operated on leverage, on borrowed money. And with all this leverage, they made what we know now were fake profits because all those $500 billion in write-downs we saw during the financial crisis wiped out years of profits. But with these fake earnings, they hired tons and tons of people. And I remember back in 2006, people were writing kind of reflective articles about what's happening to the public, what's happening that the best college graduates all want to go work on Wall Street. We're losing the best and the brightest who might have gone into engineering, into medicine. They're going to Wall Street. And when the financial crisis began, financial historians and economists said, this is the banking bubble bursting. And this might be good for society, even though it will be hard on the people who were laid off, but it might be good that we have a reallocation of bodies, of minds, of resources. These people will go into other industries. Maybe they'll do startups. Maybe they'll go look for the cure for cancer. It was delayed until now because the Fed pumped so much money through our system in the last few years. And so the banks could make money and could keep these people. But now the Fed money is over. They pulled out in the spring. And so you are seeing every bank, not just Bank of America. You are seeing Goldman Sachs, HSBC, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, JP Morgan. They are all shedding people as the banking bubble burst.
Paul Barrett, is this it? Is this the turning of the tide, rolling back the financialization of the U.S. economy? It's going to hurt for a lot of people, but could it be on balance a good thing?
Well, I think, you know, viewing this from the kind of cold-hearted corporate perspective of the health of institutions like Bank of America, there's no doubt that it's a good thing. I mean, the bank that Brian Moynihan's predecessor, Ken Lewis, built was not a rational or manageable institution. The very fact that we consider these institutions too big to fail, that sort of all honest people acknowledge that if they got to the edge, we would have to bail them out as taxpayers, is not a healthy state of affairs. So from that perspective, it's probably, as Louise was saying, in aggregate, at least a turning in the right direction, if not an actual good thing. It's not going to be a good thing anytime soon for many of these people who are being laid off. As Louise said, the banking industry does not have other jobs to absorb them. It's going to be very hard times for thousands and thousands of people. I'm a little less sanguine in terms of, you know, are we turning a corner? Because these institutions are still very big. They're still very fragile. They're still susceptible to taking risks that, in my view anyway, are too great. And we're coming nowhere close to undoing the trend that set in the 1990s and the 2000s, where investment banking was bolted together with commercial banking, where a practice of banking of using degrees of leverage that previously were unheard of is being stopped. So we're just going to have to wait and see. It's too soon to be optimistic. I think this is certainly a more positive development in the aggregate, not necessarily for any one person or one community. But, you know, I think the bankers have a lot to make up for, and we'll see in coming years whether they're able to do it.
We'll look more at the big picture. What about the nuts and bolts here? This is what, getting up towards 10% of Bank of America's workforce? They had already announced 6,000, cut back in 6,000 positions this year, now 30,000 over what period? How much of that workforce is it, Paul? And is anybody else, Louise mentions HSBC, Goldman Sachs, is anybody else cutting back on this scale?
Well, I mean, as Louise said, other banks are cutting back significantly. Bank of America is one of the biggest. So when they cut 10%, the absolute number is really, really big. But just to give you a flavor for what they're doing, Moynihan told us, for example, that over the years, that Bank of America had acquired 63 data centers, 63, warehouses filled with computers, and most of that was redundant. So they don't want to own those computers anymore, and they don't want to employ the tech people who run those computers. Now, it'll take a while to see whether all of those people and that equipment can be put to more useful purposes. But in the community that has a huge warehouse that is filled with machines that is tended to by dozens or scores of people, I mean, that's going to be rough on those people, certainly in the short term.
Louise, if it's the bubble bursting on that whole, banking gigantism era, does that mean we're headed toward lean, healthy finance sector or just bloodshed and hard times?
It's going to be a very long transition, particularly because the economy is so weak. The recovery has stalled. We might have another recession, not only in America, but globally. And banking has always moved with the economy. When we're in boom times, the banks make more money. When the economy suffers, they make less money because, people default on their loans in bad times. And so one of the things that's very hard for the financial sector right now is it does need to do a lot of reinventing on how it makes money and how it works with customers and how it works with companies. And it's hard to do that in a really stalled recovery or possibly another recession.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Bank of America slashing 30,000 jobs and what it means. Louise Story is with us, business reporter for The New York Times. Paul Barrett's here, assistant managing editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Big cover story this week on Bank of America and its CEO, Brian Moynihan, there. Brian Moynihan talked with Wall Street analysts on Monday, said the company had just grown too large in recent years.
During 2003 to 2008, our company acquired 6 major acquisitions, 200,000 employees down to 133,000 we started with, and that added a lot of complexity.
And a lot of raw numbers in a very short time. Here's the Bank of America CEO going right to the bottom line.
All the businesses we have make money except for mortgages.
Paul Barrett, is it that simple? Everything else makes money, it's just mortgages? I guess that in itself is not simple if we don't know the scale of liability on the mortgage front.
It's not that simple, but Moynihan does have one point in terms of describing the crisis at Bank of America. Were it not for its mortgage-related liabilities, were it not for Countrywide Financial, we would probably not be here today focusing specifically on Bank of America. It would look much more like its rivals. But the uncertainty surrounding Countrywide, the inability that Moynihan has right now of telling the world, okay, we've written down and set aside $30 billion so far. It's going to be another $25 billion, and that's it. And then we're back to regular business. His inability to put a price tag on it is what has spooked the stock market so much and why we're focusing so intently on Bank of America. Otherwise, it would be part of the larger mix. Now, he's not correct. It would be incorrect to interpret what he's saying as that the only problem is Countrywide and everything else is hunky-dory. Bank of America is a reflection of the entire American economy. The American economy has been in a recession, is now teetering possibly on the verge of another one. We have unemployment in excess of 9%, and under those circumstances, Bank of America would be struggling no matter what.
Paul, Louise, we've got callers just on that front. Let's go to them. Let's begin anyway. Mike in Charlotte, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. My question is, when Bank of America acquired Countrywide, was that something that was done as an idea of Ken Lewis himself, or was that something that was brokered or encouraged by the federal government? And as a result of that, who benefited directly from the acquisition of Countrywide by Bank of America?
Well, good questions. Ken Lewis, the former CEO before Brian Moynihan. Louise, Paul, Louise, let me come to you. When did they do it? Why did they do it? Who benefited directly? Our caller wants to know.
Well, the mortgage business is traditionally very profitable, servicing can make a lot of money. And so in 2007, Bank of America made an investment in Countrywide, and then they acquired it in entirety in 08. And Ken Lewis thought it would be a money machine for the bank. Of course,
so the government didn't put the arm on them to do this. This wasn't like
Merrill
Lynch.
Well, here's what is so interesting. Bank of America is a direct contrast to J.P. Morgan, okay? Because both of those giant banks acquired, each of them acquired two of the troubled companies during the crisis, okay? Bank of America acquired Merrill, one of the worst investment banks in terms of how much trouble it was in, and Countrywide. J.P. Morgan acquired Washington Mutual and Bear Stearns. Here's the difference. J.P. Morgan said to the government, we are not acquiring these without mega help from you. Bear Stearns, the government took their worst assets, and with Washington Mutual, the government took the litigation liabilities for most of that company from J.P. Morgan, leaving J.P. Morgan now with those companies and without the bad laundry. Mm-hmm. Bank of America, in what Ken Lewis understood to be a very patriotic spirit, went out and made both of these acquisitions on his own. And yes, they later got a bailout, but so did every other bank. At the time of the acquisition, Bank of America operated as an independent company. And so when you think about what do we want in capitalism, it's very interesting to think about J.P. Morgan's doing great now, and they got all this help in their mergers and acquisitions from the government, and Bank of America did on its own, and now they're a mess.
I mean, Paul Barrett, what about it? Louise's colleague Steve Devidoff is comparing today the Bank of America, you know, leaping into the storm there and buying Merrill Lynch for about $50 billion. Barclays got Lehman Brothers, for $250 million, bargain basement. They weren't going to pay that patriotic save-the-day price, and they're in pretty good shape with that now. What's the moral of the story?
Yeah, well, one moral of the story, the simplest moral of the story, is that Ken Lewis, one of the great empire builders in the financial industry, really does not look very good in retrospect. He looks like a man who made a lot of bad decisions driven by hubris and the desire simply to be among the biggest, if not the biggest. I don't know what I'm uncomfortable ascribing degrees of patriotic, motivation between one CEO of a huge bank and another CEO of a huge bank. But I think Louise's point is very much very accurate in that Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan indisputably drove better deals and did better for his shareholders than Ken Lewis. And now we're seeing Brian Moynihan, who was kind of this battlefield promotion, a guy who really very few people thought of as a CEO candidate for an institution of this size, who stepped into the breach when Lewis was when investors and board of directors at Bank of America lost faith in Lewis, and suddenly the whole thing was on Moynihan's lap. And we're seeing him cleaning up this this tremendous mess. It is true that sometimes you can pinpoint individual people who've made very bad decisions and built institutions that are very, very fragile. I mean, for example, Sandy Weill, the man who put together Citigroup, deserves a lot of the blame for the shape of Citigroup today. Same thing for Ken Lewis and Bank of America.
I don't want to lose our caller Mike's sharp nuances, though. First, who profited from that purchase of Countrywide? I mean, that was an ugly bag of business, and it wasn't exactly a secret. It was so much subprime debt in there. And was there a government role in finally encouraging Bank of America to take the whole thing?
No. This was not a situation like the Merrill acquisition. This was just a really bad decision by Ken Lewis and his lieutenants. In the long run, very few people benefited from it. It's been a financial disaster. I suppose you could say in the short run, because Countrywide was not allowed to go where it should have gone, which is to say into bankruptcy, investors in Countrywide at the time benefited from the fact that Bank of America stepped up and paid for the shares of Countrywide, because a lot of people at the time who owned shares and owned Countrywide debt would have been left with zero. They ended up with something. So if you're looking for someone who benefited, I would look there.
Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Tom. Now, Tom, you're out where Warren Buffett is. He put $5 billion into Bank of America recently. His vote of confidence got a good deal on it. What's your question, Tom?
Hi, Tom. I think one of the big problems we've got is we've let banks – I think banking has just kind of gone off the rails as far as what it used to be. They're mega massive corporations that, you know, are too big to fail, as we've talked about. But also, they're not banks anymore. They don't lend out money. They don't they don't have, you can't have a savings plan. You know, my father passed away a little over a year ago and left some money for my mother, but she has to put it in mutual funds, which is not something she wants to do and is not comfortable doing it, hates the fact, but she can't put it into a savings account because there's no interest. She would lose more in taxes than she would gain in interest.
Just feels like it's not working for an ordinary customer there. Louise, what do you say to that story from Omaha?
Well, that's going to keep going on with these really low interest rates we have. The banks will not be paying much interest on deposits for a long time. And in fact, at least with institutional clients, you've already have some banks that are paying negative interest, basically charging these companies to hold their money for them. And I could see that coming to the consumer front in not that long, given that the interest rates for the bank, they're going to stay so low. The banks don't have places they can really reinvest people's deposits to make profits on it, so they don't feel like they can pay people. It's really a tough time right now for anyone to figure out how to make money on their savings, because you're right, you can't get it in a bank, and even mutual funds and the stock market seem a lot riskier than they used to seem. And so it's definitely a tough time to figure out where to park your money.
Talk about grim. I mean, paying the bank to keep your cash safer than it would be in your pillow. A lot of these cutbacks in jobs at Bank of America, Louise, have come on the consumer side. Bill here asks online or says what it means is that the shrinking level of lower and middle class U.S. dollars, income, wealth are no longer worth the trouble of going after. Is that possible?
Well, you know, Bank of America also has been one of the many banks that have been closing some of their branches. And what you're seeing is they're trying to get people to do online banking and to use technology so that they don't have to pay people to be there in person and help you out if you have a question. And I think that raises the question of, what do we want from our banks? You know, do we want to be able to go in and talk to someone? And if that's the case, what it's going to mean over time is that consumers have to pay more for banking services. If you want to go in and talk to people and have a branch that's staffed, you're going to have higher monthly fees on your checking and saving accounts so that they can pay those people to be standing there.
And yet there they are. Andrew in Stoneham, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. I had a question for your guests. I'm a small business owner and have had a long relationship with Bank of America. I currently have 3 credit accounts there and 1 remaining depository account. I've been moving them away. But frankly, it's a total mess. About a week ago, they withdrew about $2,000 from my depository account to pay a credit account, and it took the bank several days to even figure out where the funds had gone to. So I'm curious. I know on the home loan side, they've had some government intervention and some pressure to get the paperwork cleaned up and to make sure there's sort of been an orderly dealing with the problems there. Do you see the same thing happening in the other areas of the bank where there might be either intervention or supervision to make sure that as they downsize, they get these types of problems in order?
Paul Barrett, what do you say?
Well, I'm personally unaware of there being any extraordinary measures being taken right now in that regard. I suppose it's important to emphasize that federal bank regulatory agencies are continually looking over the shoulder of bankers. The Fed, the Treasury, they have examiners who are on site at bank facilities and are supposed to be keeping an eye on such things. But no, so far as I know, there's no sense of emergency or that somehow Bank of America is no longer able to handle the petty cash.
Louise, I mean, it's hard for people to get perspective on this. On the one hand, you hear Wall Street wise guys talking about Bank of America and other banks, and saying, oh, we don't know if they have enough fingers to put in the dike. On the other hand, huge bank, huge revenues, a lot of business going on, and presumably orderly working of normal operations is not a big deal.
Well, consumers don't have many options on where to bank. It's interesting the caller was talking about moving his money out. In every town now there are a lot fewer options to go to since we've had such consolidation. So over time that does mean that banks, may have less good services. And if there's not a competitor down the street, it won't be a problem. And this is what we worry about when oligopolies are created, is that no one can really compete with these giant banks. And so their services will just go downhill. The other thing to think about when you think of these layoffs and what we're seeing in banking is when a CEO of a bank looks at his cash flow and says, okay, I've got to cut some expenses, he looks at that compensation line, and the amount of money they spend on compensation is humongous. And he could do a couple different things to bring that amount down. Yes, he could lay off people, like Brian Moynihan at Bank of America is doing. But he could also say, well, we're not going to lay off quite as many people. What we're going to do is we're going to pay everyone a little less this year. But that goes against the Wall Street ethos. At least in New York here, when you look at investment banking, these people are still making hundreds of thousands of dollars, often more than $500,000. And so even with these layoffs, you may still see the per person average be pretty high. And so there's a lot of questions to ask here in banking about whether they should be cutting bodies or cutting bonuses.
Louise Story, Paul Barrett, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from London, Campbell Harvey. He's professor of international business at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, down in the neighborhood of Bank of America's, broadly speaking, of Bank of America's headquarters in Charlotte. He's editor of the Journal of Finance blogs at gardenofecon.com. Campbell Harvey, thanks for being with us.
Good to be on the show, Tom.
What do you think we should be thinking as we look at American banking right now? Bank of America's got the headlines this week, but we've got issues on many fronts here. Are we seeing the end of too big to fail? What's going on?
Well, I can't resist responding to something that Luis just said. Mm-hmm. We've got plenty of banks in the U.S. Actually, it's part of the problem. We've got 7,000 banks. So it's not an oligopoly problem. We do have 19 large banks, but other countries have done perfectly well with a so-called oligopoly system, like Canada, where they've got basically 10 banks. They have not had a failure. Even in the Great Depression, when over 1,000 U.S. banks failed, Canada did not have one failure.
So what are we doing wrong? I mean, we've got a lot of concentration, if you look at where the money is, certainly.
Yeah, a lot of this has to do with leverage. So the problem with Bank of America right now is they are scrambling to reduce their leverage. And they've taken, you know, about six extraordinary steps, like exiting the credit card business, their international credit card business, taking on this money from Warren Buffett, just a remarkable rate of return that's expected for Buffett. They dumped half their CCB, the China Bank position. They're looking to dump their mortgage business, and now they're going to lay off 30,000 people and supposedly save $5 billion. It's a scramble to get capital because right now their leverage is too high, and that is the problem. If you have high leverage in your system, then you're going to have crisis after crisis.
Meaning they don't have enough, or you'd like to see a different ratio of cash on hand to what they're lending and the risk that comes with that.
That's exactly it. And yesterday, you know, I'm in London right now, and a special report was released on the future of banking in the UK. And essentially, this report said that forget the Basel III regulations.
That is the new tougher standards for more money on hand relative to what you lend out.
Right. So we're going to do something more severe than Basel III, plus another 10%. And that's basically the model of Switzerland right now. So if you've got like 20% capital on hand, then you're going to greatly diminish the chance of a crisis.
What do American banks tend to have on hand?
There's a debate right now as to whether they will even adhere to the Basel III, the Basel III, in my opinion, is way too low. So for systemically important banks, the ratio would go up to 9.5%. For other banks, about 7%. It implies even if you think of a ratio of 10%, that implies leverage of 10 to 1. That's huge compared to other corporates. No other industry that we've got would be allowed to have leverage of 10 to 1.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bank of America this week announcing it will cut back 30,000 jobs and what that means about this bank, about U.S. banking more broadly. Paul Barrett's here from Bloomberg Business Week. He's helped write a big cover story there on Bank of America. Louise Story is with us from the New York Times. He's done a lot of great reporting on everything in finance in the last few years here. Campbell Harvey is with us. He's with Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, editor at the Journal of Finance, joining us today from London. Louise Story, how about Campbell Harvey on leverage? What's allowed in this country, the norm in this country versus what we see around the world? Do we need more government pressure to make banks change the ratio of cash to lending?
This is a real point of tension right now with Wall Street and the government. In fact, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, came out just last weekend and said that America should not follow those international standards that are coming up. And in fact, he said he called them un-American because...
you might be right, but I don't know if that's good in this case.
He called them un-American because, you know, it could... from his point of view, it could hold back banks from lending as much as he thinks they should. And so, you know, America, I don't know how to get into his patriotic theory on this one, but that's what he said. And it's going to be interesting to see how this debate continues. I think it would be a very different story now if the economy had recovered. I think the financial crisis would be fresh in everyone's mind. And so we would have all these reforms. We would have stricter capital rules. But what is giving the people who are arguing we shouldn't have the stricter reforms and the stricter capital, what is giving them ammunition and kind of a foothold here is that the economy is so weak that everyone's a little bit scared that we could do something that could make it weaker. And could these capital rules really make banks not lend more? I mean, no one really, really knows for sure. We all know there was too much leverage, but what's the right amount? No one knows. There's not a recipe. And so you've got this big clash of opinion. The banking sector is saying, don't make us take away all the leverage because then we won't be able to lend as much. And then a lot of really great academics and policymakers saying, no, no, you guys have got to be reined in.
Paul Barrett, is a weak, two-week or even weakening economy here a reason to loosen up on capital, you know, rules? Or does that just get us back into Wild West territory?
Well, I don't think anyone's proposing to loosen up capital rules. It's a question of to what degree they're going to be made more stringent, A, and B, to what degree will they be globalized? And I think there actually is a very broad consensus that the leverage levels that we saw during the early and mid-2000s and that fueled the real estate craze have to be a thing of the past. I also think that there's a consensus that some type of international regime would be a good idea. The question is in the details, at precisely what level will we get a good balance between banks lending money at the rate that we'd like to see them lend money on the one hand versus banks being solid and there being kind of a bulwark against a future crisis on the other hand. All of this, though, is in a sense a symptom of one huge trend going back 20 years and the breaking down of traditional walls between different types of banking and the building of these huge institutions and our reconceiving of banking as a go-go growth business that has to produce quarterly results that compete with any other business. I mean, we tend to forget that once commercial banking, in any event, the banks that were publicly traded, that was a very boring business, a slow-moving business, a plodding business, and one that for 40, 50 years after the Great Depression was relatively solid. And then there was another sort of strain of banking, investment banking, companies that were privately held, some of them partnerships, where they took higher risks, and if they failed, they failed. They were gambling with their own money. So we're now dealing with the fallout from having set aside the notion that that strict federal regulation of banks is a good thing. We're dealing with the fallout from a period of extreme anti-regulatory ideology. And we have a mess, and we're having to sort it out.
So, Campbell Harvey, you're there in London looking on at Europe. Who's got the better banking situation at this point? I mean, we're hearing all about Europe's sovereign debt problems. They got banks in big there. Moody's, just in the last day, has downgraded two huge French banks on their long-term debt ratings. So does that mean they're in more trouble than U.S. banks or what?
Yes, but the U.S. banks are at risk. I'll choose Canada again because I think it's a really model system that has performed consistently well over the last 100 years. Look, this is not, I know the banks spin this story that if you increase our regulatory capital, we'll have to lend less. It's not about lending. It's about the amount of risk that they can take and the profit that they can make. And the banks have done just an amazingly good job at lobbying the government for, and the regulators, the international regulators, for a leverage that is really, really high. And it's a question, yes, it is an economic question. If there is less leverage or less lending, it might be that we have slightly lower growth. But if we have the leverage that we've got today, then we run the risk of another economic crisis like we had in 2008. And the cost is not 30,000 jobs at Bank of America today. The cost could be 3 million jobs or more if we go into another financial crisis. So we need to make a decision as a country as to what we want to do with our banking system. Do we want to run it at extreme leverage and then have to go and bail out these banks? How many times do we have to bail out Citibank?
And where is that being decided? Where is that on the table right now, Campbell? Where are the lobbyists lining up?
The Federal Reserve has the power of basically setting the requirements. Right now, we've got unbelievable dysfunctionality in our regulatory system. Let me give you one example, and this is an important one. The recent stress test, the stress test done in the summer of 2011, had an adverse scenario. So this is the worst scenario that they looked at, where they test the banks in terms of whether they'll survive in terms of capital.
Yeah.
The 2012 GDP growth projection for the adverse scenario was 2.4%, and 2013 was 3.4%. And I mean positive.
Is that bad? I don't know how to interpret what you're saying, Campbell.
So they're saying the worst scenario, okay, that you need to plan for, has positive growth in 2012 and excellent growth.
Oh, I see. And our growth rate is below that, well below right now.
Does that sound like an adverse scenario to you?
Yeah, but wait a minute. We've been hearing for the last year and more from, I don't know, banks, Republicans, that regulation's going way too far on banks. Get rid of Dodd-Frank.
No, that's the problem. The adverse scenario is basically not adverse. It's like a good scenario. And the banks fulfill the stress test. It seems like they're okay. But then all of a sudden people realize, well, gee, the assumptions in the stress test are bogus. And I believe that the regulators are fooled to thinking that our banking system is healthier. I believe that the banks themselves are fooled by this. Indeed, you know, the Bank of America asked to increase their dividend in March. Can you believe that?
Campbell, you're from down in their neck of the woods. I'm going to take that to Louise, but I've got to let you go in a minute. What's North Carolina thinking about this bank that's been a big prize and pride right there with its headquarters?
Yes, and it is a big deal, obviously, locally in Charlotte, because the bulk of those jobs will be lost in our area. But we are also hit by this economic slowdown caused by the financial crisis. And I believe that people would prefer some stability. We don't want a situation where we're up and down and now we're in a situation with an unemployment rate that is unacceptably high. So I think the people in North Carolina are willing to take some sacrifice here for a more stable situation. And right now we just don't have that.
Campbell Harvey at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, editor of the Journal of Finance, joining us today from London. Campbell, thanks for being with us.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks a lot. Louise Story, what about that scenario, stress testing banks on a worst-case scenario that's better than what we're actually up against? Where's the action on this? Is there action on this? Louise, is there a struggle going on under the covers somewhere right now about what leverage is going to be allowed and how regulation is going to be enforced? Should it be tightened up? Do you agree with Campbell?
Well, there absolutely is a struggle across not only the leverage and capital rules, but also every sort of financial reform that is supposed to be put in place under the Dodd-Frank bill that was passed a year ago. And what we've seen is that the SEC and all of the different regulatory agencies that are supposed to roll out these rules are behind schedule. They're weakening the rules. And in fact, it looks like a lot of the rules might not even get done. You've got a lot of lawmakers in Congress, mostly on the Republican side, but some on the Democrat side, who are calling for a lot of these rules to be canceled. And if you see Congress change where it's completely Republican, you've had a number of Republicans say publicly they will try to pass new legislation or at the very least continue to defund some of the regulatory agencies so that reforms just simply cannot take place. This is very heavily pushed by the banking sector. They want to be able to run free and, you know, footloose and fancy like they used to. And so it's a real struggle. The problem is we don't have really clear leadership out there from anyone in government telling us what banking should look like. No one has really sat down and designed the ideal. So we're all floundering with all these lobbyists bumping into each other looking for a solution.
John in Boston, you're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm wondering, what's a reasonable profit expectation that we can have in banks? Because it seems that it's completely out of whack.
Profit expectation. Okay. What do you mean?
You know, banks seem to be competing with the likes of Google, eBay, you know, the IT companies, where, you know, profits of 20-30% on money is reasonable. Bank is supposed to be a boring, reliable sector. You know, if you're trying to get 30% money out of a bank, you're going to end up with absurd leverage.
John, let us look at it. Paul, what about it? Is it just the basic profit expectations of American banks are set too high? Are they really higher than other countries around the world banks?
I think there is a kernel of something very profound in the caller's question. We did, as I said earlier, we did come to reconceive of what banking was all about. You know, beginning in the late 70s and certainly into the 80s, and it was powerfully put into effect in the 90s when we basically dismantled some of the basic regulatory limitations on how banks can behave, and we unleashed the modern era of mega banks that combined both super high-risk investment banking, proprietary trading, derivatives trading on the one hand, and commercial and consumer activity on the other, and we allowed these institutions to grow hugely in size, and the conception of what a bank was did change. The idea that banks could combine these very, very high risk activities with the much broader, higher volume activities, that all of this would be funded by public investors and tacitly backed up by federal guarantees, you know, was a new thing that was brought to us in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, all floated on the ideology that Alan Greenspan popularized, that basically the regulators never know what they're doing, the private sector always knows what it's doing, and big financial institutions can be counted on to sort of check each other and counter each other. And it just turned out that ideology was wrong.
And here we are. Benita in Jacksonville, Florida. Thanks for calling, Benita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My grandmother used to have a saying, you never trust a fox to guard the chicken coop. And unfortunately, it seems like we have a comedy of errors with the American taxpayers continuing to pay for these terrible decisions that are made in a corporate office that ultimately affect the workers of that company.
Yep.
The question that I have is, when the financial collapse happened and the government was looking to actually bail out these banks and create this money to do that, why didn't they create an alternative to provide money to smaller credit unions and smaller community banks in those areas where you had hard populations of people being hurt because of the toxic mortgages, where they could work with their local banks and keep their homes and not lose their homes under this terrible crisis?
Benita, our time is short, but Louise, let me pick that up with you. I mean, is there a way to, if the big banks don't want so much to do the sort of humdrum, boring, low-margin work, could that have been, or could it even now be shifted to, I don't know, credit unions or somebody who wants to do that? Just do
but
the
Tom,
simple straight-ahead banking.
But you have to ask yourself, why did we bail them out? Okay, if they don't want to do the banking that the country needs across the country, why are we saving them? Why are we bailing them out? And we really missed an opportunity in 2008 when they were bailed out to rethink what banking is, to ask questions about maybe these shouldn't be such profit-seeking institutions. Maybe they have a public duty in terms of how they treat their customers, in terms of the role they play in the economy, especially since we bailed them out. There was no thinking done on that. They were given the bailouts with no strings attached to them, very few rules. And now we're left with a situation where they survived thanks to the taxpayer help, but they are allowed to operate, you know, with the exception of some regulations, they're allowed to operate by and large how they want and go look for profits.
Benita, I think you're onto something there. Hold that flame. Paul Barrett, what's the expectation for Bank of America at this point? Does it look like this level of cutting will get them out of the woods? Are they still? Are we going to be hearing more about them and other banks in the year ahead? Does it all depend on what happens with the economy?
Well, I can certainly say that the answer to the last question is yes. What happens with the economy will be the biggest influence on Bank of America and on its rivals. As to the job cuts, no. The job cuts alone are not going to put this this bank right. Bank of America will not be out from under the shadow that it's now operating under until a price tag is put on the countrywide financial liability.
And that is still unfolding, as people know all across this country, with foreclosure rates and everything else. Well, you put your toe in these waters, and it can look scary in a hurry, but we wish everybody luck here. May it all work out well. May the economy come right on back, too. Louise Story with the New York Times, it's great having you. We always enjoy having you here with us, and thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
Paul Barrett with Bloomberg Business Week, thanks for the big story this week in the magazine. Cover story, good work there, and thank you for joining us, Paul.
You bet. Thanks.
Listeners, thank you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.